The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Yes, we have stagflation. No, there's no stable equilibrium. Yes, there are inputs into companies that are tagging the bottom line for corporations and have them cautious in terms of business spending, which leaves us with one conclusion. Guess what? Early 2017, the markets are likely to be roiled because the only Hail Mary is fiscal policy spending, and you can't snap your fingers and make it happen.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, I'm still simmering from the Carmen Reinhart interview. I'm ruminating on all the things that she said. It was amazing to me to have somebody from what I would call sort of behind the curtain, sort of from the ivory towers, from the Jackson Hole meetings, the meetings with central bankers, and, you know, the giving of and taking advice from. This is somebody who shared with you last week what people really need to be looking forward to, because these are the people who will probably make the policies.
Well, so it's just reality. Whether you like it or not, this is the way the direction of policymaking is going. These are the kinds of things that policymakers are thinking and being advised upon. And it should come as no surprise when there are realities which you encounter within the financial system reflective of the kinds of conversations we've been having really for the last couple of years. But it comes into focus when it's not you and I saying it, when it's actually an advisor to the policymaker who says, hey, this is the conversation we just had. And it's coming down the pike.
Well, and I mentioned to you last night when we were talking, I said it used to be fun when we would call something a conspiracy and try to prove why something was happening. But when people are actually looking back and saying, yes, it's not a conspiracy, this is truly the plan, and it's for your own good, it's definitely worth taking note.
So the question is, how do we respond? Is our response one of just taking it in stride and saying, oh, okay, well, then I guess that's the way it is? Or do we look and say, why is it that we object to this? Is there something fundamentally missing from the equation? Something like permission granted, something like the freedom to opt out,
right?
Things that correspond to our basic notions of political philosophy and the role of government in our life, where we would say, actually, these are very fascinating ideas, but just so you know, there are two ways to approach. Of course, there's many more than two, but there's at least two ways to approach public policy choices. And what makes these decisions so difficult to swallow is that they're really not consistent with anything that we hold dear in terms of our being agents in the system making choices freely.
Well, yeah, freedom. Well, you know, let's get to that in a little while. I'd like to talk about Carmen Reinhart's comments, and then I'd also like to sort of look ahead to Kenneth Rogoff's book, The Curse of Cash, because the details of what we should be looking for are both in the Reinhart interview and in The Curse of Cash. But I want to get to some of what the Federal Reserve, speaking of central bankers, have been dependent on here recently. We call it data dependence, but is it really data dependence, or is it just coming up with a number dependence?
Data dependence conveys that what they're doing has rhyme and reason. The issue is, of course, that the goalposts that they've used, what they've defined as data dependence or the goals that they have in mind, they've shifted. They've shifted very frequently throughout the last 5 years, so many times that it's almost not worth counting. And so what does the Fed do now in this environment where, again, data dependence, they should have raised rates several years ago and they didn't because, again, those goalposts have been moved.
Right.
Now all they can do is make blanket promises. And to what effect? What is the effect of making a blanket promise?
Well, it creates investments in places that normally would not be invested in.
Well, right. And that's exactly what we saw following the Mario Draghi blanket promise of I'll do whatever it takes. We saw risk reflected in interest rates all of a sudden move from very high numbers over the course of 3-4 years to negative numbers in many cases, where the problem countries in Europe, the peripheral European countries, which had been called the pigs using the acronym sort of unceremoniously, these are the ones that all of a sudden their 10-year treasuries were yielding less than the U.S. 10-year treasury, as if they were a better credit
right.
than the United States. And that, again, you make a blanket promise. And as you say, what's the effect? You have malinvestment, which is to say a misallocation of capital towards riskier and riskier assets. And now you look at the markets and you have to say, well, where do we go from here? The Fed is very much along for the ride from this point forward. And arguably they have been up to this point as well. If the markets swoon, what are they going to do? They'll reverse course instantly. And which led? Was it the market or the Fed? Was the Fed decision making what drove the markets, or was the market actually driving what the Fed was doing?
Well, and I thought that was interesting last week when you asked Carmen Reinhart if possibly price stability, which is one of the Fed mandates, has moved from prices of apples, oranges, milk, that type of thing, to just stability of the market. Have you noticed how the stock market, every time it gets near 18,000, somebody steps in and says, oh, no, no, we don't like 17,990. We want it above 18,000. That's a new form of price stability, I think.
Well, that's right, because it's basically taken that notion of price stability into the twilight zone. It used to be that price stability meant prices of goods and services. And the stability mandate was dealing with the value of the currency as it was reflected in the price of goods and services. Now, the price stability mandate has to do with asset prices, specifically stocks and bonds. And that was clear, as we talked to Carmen Reinhart last week, that somehow there's been some confusion in terms of the language. But price stability now means broad financial stability, which means controlling the prices within the financial markets. That's a far cry from quote-unquote price stability as it relates to goods and services reflected by the stability of the currency itself.
Well, and you know, price stability comes in a lot of different forms. I mean, they can actually intervene on a market and buy stocks these days, and we can talk more about that later. But literally, verbal manipulation seems to be the major way that they go about it. I mean, the Fed's meeting with the Bank of Japan this week. We'll probably have some surprise statements coming out. One may move the market up, one may move the market down, but they seem to balance their statements to balance the market.
Right, and that's what we have on the docket for this week. The Fed meets, will announce a rate increase, probably of a quarter point. Maybe they'll do nothing. But the Bank of Japan, they'll also meet. And will they promise the sun, moon, and stars, or will they acknowledge that negative rates are crushing the financial system? Some of your biggest banks in Japan, just like your biggest banks in Germany, have been crying foul. The consequence of negative interest rates is that it's stripping profitability and putting them in a very precarious place, where if they continue down this road much further, the very viability of those firms is in question. So you have those two meetings, the Bank of Japan and the Fed this week, Wednesday and Thursday, will prove to be very interesting in terms of market dynamics. There's potential for a lot of volatility. After the meetings, what do you have next? Very little except the unannounced or unscheduled speeches from various monetary policy makers.
To balance perception.
To balance perception and to correct the direction of a market and sort of guide it a little bit more. Look at what happened a week ago. We had the markets falling apart Friday, week before last, and that was on the discussion of higher rates. That was Friday. Market closed weak, but by the time the market was closing, there was a last-minute announcement that Lyle Brainard would be speaking on Monday. And one of the reasons you would do that is so that there's not panic that carries over from Friday into the Monday trading market.
Well, they've trained people that if the markets go down, somebody's going to talk about something that might be dovish, what they would call dovish, that would push the market back up.
Right. So Lyle Brainard makes the unscheduled speech on Monday, buoys the markets with dovish insinuation, and really, talk is all they have after the 21st of this month. Here's a direct quote from Brainard's speech last Monday. Japan remains greatly challenged by weak growth and low inflation. Indeed, it is striking that despite active and creative monetary policies in both the euro area and Japan, inflation remains below target levels. The experiences of these economies highlight the risk of becoming trapped in a low-growth, low-inflation, low-inflation expectations environment and suggest that policy should be oriented towards minimizing the risk of the U.S. economy slipping back into such a situation. End quote. Now, the interesting thing is, this is a person who would be more than happy to do negative interest rates.
Right.
And they're saying, well, look, what happened is, it's not that negative interest rates are not helping Japan and Eurozone countries. It's that they didn't implement them fast enough and to the degree that they needed to. And that's why they're still suffering. There's an inability on her part to recognize that it may be the policy itself which is reinforcing a negative deflationary or disinflationary trend. Again, I'm talking about a paradigmatic blindness. They
Right.
cannot see what they do not want to see because it challenges the paradigm from within which they operate.
Well, Dave, if your whole life is a particular paradigm, it's very hard to see outside of that paradigm. There's job security. There's a lot of other things. You've got papers that have been written for the last few decades. So you have to stick with the paradigm and make everything everything else fit.
Right. The challenges of weak growth boil down to one thing, whether it's the U.S. economy, Japan, or Germany in the Eurozone, it's too much debt.
Right.
There's too much debt in the economy, and there's not enough economic activity to stay on top of or ahead of that mountain of debt.
Well, and Carmen Reinhart brought up last week the debt overhang, and you two both discussed the fact that now that they have allowed this debt to get as large as it is, the growth may be stalled for what, the next 24 years?
Well, that's right. I'm looking at a number of papers sitting here in front of me, an anatomy of credit booms and their demise. Under what circumstances can inflation be a solution to excessive national debt? Some lessons from history by Michael Bordeaux, one of our previous guests. The liquidation of government debt by Carmen Reinhart. These are National Bureau of Economic Research contributors, and they point to two primary solutions supported broadly by most academics today. Number one, you inflate away the burden of debt, or number two, you use financial repression as a means of passing the burden around, because it is, after all, the debt stupid. And
right.
This is where Ms. Brader would do well to say, look, it's not policies, new, inventive, creative, that will solve this problem. It's the foundation upon which our financial system is built, which is excessive debt, which has to be reanalyzed. This is simply unsustainable.
Well, and Reinhart brought up, you use both. That's what they're looking for. They were talking about possibly maybe changing the inflation target from 2% to 4%. Well, what is that? That's to inflate away the debt while continuing negative real rates of return and possibly even nominal rates of return.
Now, the assumption is that the general public is too stupid to understand, and so they can discuss these things very openly. They don't need to be guarded because Monday Night Football trumps all, or whatever it is that keeps people distracted. You know, where public policy matters not, entertainment matters everything.
All right, now, but I have to, you're hitting me where it hurts, okay? Because last night I was watching Monday Night Football with the clicker set to go back to Dancing with the Stars. Back to Monday Night Football, Dancing with the Stars, Monday Night Football. But I was reading Ken Rogoff's book, okay? The Curse of Cash.
That's right. Well, sometime in October, we expect to visit with Ken. And you may wonder, why do we have these conversations if, in essence, we're not learning anything new? Well, here it is. I may have formed opinions, and I may have begun discussing some of these ideas, like financial repression, 2, even 3 years ago with our clients.
Right.
But at that time, the ideas were sort of locked away in the ivory tower.
Mm-hmm.
And so, sure, reading through countless academic papers, it was just as clear then as it is now what the options for central planners would be, and that those options were narrowing, that they would either have to inflate away the burden of debt or redistribute the costs of debt quietly throughout the economy using regulation, using rate policies. Then these are the only courses that the world's central bankers had available to them that were politically viable. There's other things that they can do, but these are the most politically viable.
Dave, at those times, you were coming to your own conclusions, not based on what they were saying, but what you could see as a natural outcome of their policies. Now, can you believe the candor that they're coming out? They're just coming right out, bold-faced, and saying, yes, we are going to need, well, I'm going to use Carmen Reinhart's words, we're going to need to find an opaque way to pick your pocket.
Right. So what's novel is the candor and openness on these topics now expressed by the advisors to policymakers. And it's important that you hear it from the horse's mouth.
Right.
The Fed is trapped. The central banking community is desperate, and they are in hopes of a miracle. But in case that miracle does not arrive, they're going to do what they can to keep a game face on and say, well, here's exactly what we need to do in the context of the next crisis. Central bankers do have options. Yes, they do have options. What are those options? Well, to a large degree, it's socializing the negative costs associated with economic rebalancing.
It's on your back, Dave. That's what it means.
That's right. We're going to take over indebtedness in the system, again, which Lyle Brainard would say, that's not the problem. We just have to figure out the right policy to deal with our current environment. Well, it is the debt, stupid.
Well, all right. I want to roll back the time just a little bit here. Okay, let's go back to Princeton back in the early 2000s, all right? And you've got a paper that's being released by a guy I had never heard of, Ben Bernanke, and he's talking about helicopter cash, and he's also talking about how we can avoid the next depression. Now, little did I know, he wasn't just talking about something he was interested in, but I think he had a future event in mind, a future position possibly at the Federal Reserve. Do you think Rogoff is gunning for some sort of position himself?
It certainly seems that way to me. I mean, if you look at most of the papers and most of the books that he's ever published, they're co-authored pieces.
Right.
And he's a major contributor, of course, but so are the other co-authors.
Right.
The Curse of Cash There's no other name on that cover but his.
Right.
And I think he's basically saying, in the context of the next crisis, I will be the policy implementer. I will be not only the grandmaster chess champion who wins privately, but I'm going to win publicly for everyone. And by the way, this is not just a policy advertisement. This is a personal advertisement. Ken Rogoff is for hire for Treasury Secretary.
Well, okay. All right. So let's look at this possibly, because he is, just reading his book, he brilliantly writes about something that I personally don't care much for seeing happen, which is the elimination of cash, which Carmen Reinhart brought up last week as a way of creating a captive audience. Now, speaking of captive and captured, you had passed over something that I think people may not know. Ken Rogoff is one of those few people in the entire world alive right now that's called a GM, a Grand Master. And I don't know how many there are, but there are thousands of masters, but there are only hundreds of grandmasters.
Maybe 150 alive in any given decade.
Okay.
Don't trifle with his brain. It's a good one.
Right.
No, but what is this again? We're talking about economic rebalancing. We're talking about paying the price of having too much debt in the system. And we're talking about there being an involuntary assignment, that is, payment by other people that had no connection with the debt being accumulated in the first place. They're now being asked to take some of the burden themselves. So again, we come back to this issue of surprising candor. Mm-hmm. There's openness that suggests that some are seeking official positions in the new administration, and they want to publicize not only their ideas, but themselves as the correct implementors. And it's Rogoff's dream of a cashless society, which is, in his mind, noble. What is it in reality? Well, maybe it is noble. Maybe we're wrong in picking it to pieces, but to us, it seems to be the conjuring of a priest that right. doesn't realize how deeply involved he is in the dark arts. And what are those dark arts? They're otherwise known as the dismal science. I mean, and everyone acknowledges that economics is a dark science. But if you go back to our conversation with Tomasz Selicek,
right.
who was the economic advisor to Vaclav Havel, another very bright man. By the way, he attained that position under Havel at the age of 23. I mean, he was very much way too smart for his britches at a very young age. But that was all after communism fell in Czechoslovakia. What he said was that central bankers are the high priests of a religion that promises perpetual growth. That's not actually natural, normal. You cannot accept perpetual growth as a state of nature. And to try to perpetuate it means that you bring in outside things that may ultimately be harmful to the system.
Well, and I was thinking about this the other day, Dave. The Reinhart Rogoff book in 2009, called This Time is Different, actually outlines 8 centuries of the creation of debt and then the passing of that debt, basically the default on that debt over those 8 centuries, without exception, okay? The governments go into debt, they then somehow default. Like Carmen said, it could be reworking the terms, or it can be an outright default, like we saw with all the countries that were in Europe in 1934 on America. Now, with that being said, okay, these systems really are designed for future theft. That's what debt is. If you go into debt, or let's say you borrow money from me with the understanding that you will default on that debt, that's the same thing as theft.
I'm taking your money today
yes.
with the awareness that it's not going to all be paid back.
Right.
It's certainly not fair dealings.
This has become policy. After these studies, they've said, well, this is how we're going to do it next. We're going to default on this debt. Now, the default will be done in a way, in this case, financial repression, higher inflation, lower interest rates. Over time, that inflation eats away at that debt, and it just supposedly goes away through correct management.
Or lower nominal rates altogether. And so Ken, as an academic, operates from within the paradigm that accepts this, that
right.
PhD management of the economy allows for perpetual growth. That's the paradigm. That's the world he lives in.
Right.
And he is amongst the growing cadre of neo-Keynesians that borrow from Knut Wicksell, the Swedish economist, a very legitimate idea, the idea of the natural rate of interest. But then there is this presumption that's brought in, much more than Wicksell ever did. It's a presumption both of their abilities as market tinkers, as well as I think there's some presumption in terms of the market's reaction to their tinkering. But it's based on believing that PhDs can redefine the natural rate of interest and thus engineer growth in the economy.
Well, and I think we have to look at how a person thinks, Dave. Okay, I'm a musician, so I think a certain way. I play trumpet, I like jazz, classical. One of your traits is to think in legacy. You reverse engineer everything. You look at how you're going to be as a gray-haired old man, and you say, okay, what can I do today to get to that point? That's a way of thinking. Now, think about Rogoff for a second. Now, this is not a criticism, but chess is a very, very unique game. When you study game theory and its different incarnations, there are games that can have unexpected inputs. A backgammon player is going to be able to handle surprise, even though there's an element of strategy, there's an element of chance in it. Chess has none of that. You have to close the system. You've got 64 squares. The pieces can only move a certain way. You have absolutely no surprise, unexpected events. And isn't it interesting that this is a man who's saying, if we close the system, if we make cash unavailable to people, we'll just get these equations right.
But this is what I'm getting at. There's a presumption that there's only a set number of moves that we can make, or that if we considered ourselves the opponent in the match,
right,
that there's only a few outcomes that are in front of us. Choose A, choose B, choose C.
Right.
And I would say, well, life is not chess, and that would be representing the fallacy of false alternative. We don't have A, B, and C. We have A through Z in terms of the choices ahead of us. So you and I think of interest rate disequilibrium when we look at rates at zero or below.
Right.
Okay. That's what we see. We think, gosh, if you take rates below a natural level, which to us would represent risk and credit appraisal, right?
Well, and we might march with our money.
And so you lower that, and we'd say, this is not normal. That's not so with the priesthood.
Right.
The priesthood sees a mathematical equation that unlocks perpetual growth. So to an engineering mind, it's like the perpetual motion machine. To the chemist, it's like the promise of turning dirt into gold through some new alchemy. But there is something missing in the equation.
Right.
And what is one key variable left out of the economist's quote unquote elegant equation?
You have humans and they do not act rationally.
Right. So if you boiled it down to human action, you'd say, well, if monetary policy becomes coercive and requires a captive audience within a contained financial order to thereby be implemented,
right,
they've neglected a variable rooted in our nature as people. Call it a penchant for freedom, but coercion sets in motion a very different mood amongst individuals.
Well, and to them, it may be a variable. To me, it's a constant. I love freedom. To you, it's a constant. And so the only way you can take away that constant or subdue that constant is to create force or coercion or some sort of penalty that would force me to play ball.
It's the central planner saying, what you consider to be a constant, I consider to be a negotiable.
Right.
It doesn't have to be there. And so let's call us the economic agents. We're the economic agents. To be at the receiving end of a coercive monetary policy may very well alter our behavior in unforeseen ways. You cannot assume that individuals will act normally or do more of what is considered normal or desirable when you create an environment of financial duress. And that's exactly what coercion is.
Well, let's just look at a story back from the 1700s, okay? Lavoisier, who is the discoverer and measurer of oxygen, okay? Great chemist. If you look him up on Wikipedia, most of what you'll see is his brilliant mind in chemistry. But he also, just like Rogoff, plays chess and has economic policy. Lavoisier proposed a wall around Paris so that no one could come out or go in without some sort of tariff or tax.
Well, that's right. So if you're going to import goods into the city limits of Paris, you have to pay the tax.
Well, now, he ultimately lost his head when France, you were talking about the behavior changes when freedom is taken away. Part of his behavior as far as trying to create captive audiences cost him his head, and it actually cost science about 100 years of new discovery because he was a brilliant man.
Right. Well, I think this is what ends up being dangerous. And this is by no means threatening. It's just a reality. When you begin to corner people and say, you only have options A or B, if they're not in their best interest, if they feel that their survival or well-being is challenged by the limited options you've provided, you may find that they force option C. And if they have to go through you to get to option C, That's Lavoisier. The wall fell apart. The revolution destroyed what was a nice closed system of massive taxation. I mean, this is a 27-kilometer wall around Paris. Right. Do you know the expense that they went to capture the tax franchise, to make sure that they had a solid means of taxing individuals as they came and went?
Well, and once the people rebelled, anyone that was considered elite, there was no one above losing their head on the guillotine.
Right. So the problem is you can lose a lot in terms of academic talent when there is a revolution of that kind. Carmen noted last week that the key to operating the dark arts of neo-Wixillian Keynesianism, which is what we're talking about when we're talking about redefining the natural rate, it's a combination of Keynesian demand management on the one hand and Wixillian redefining the natural rate management. That's what they're blending. How do you do that? How do you operate in those dark arts? Opacity. If you're going to pick someone's pocket, you cannot let them know you're doing it. So again, consider the genuineness of her concerns. Yes, she's an academic. Yes, she's in the ivory tower. And yes, she is calling a spade, and I really respect that.
She sounded concerned to me. I mean, she may be within the walls talking about these policies, but I think she understands them and is concerned.
My guess is that she probably is thinking more about the future,
right?
More about her son, her retirement, than she is the next political appointed position.
Yeah, you're right. You know, I was listening to her thinking, what is it that drives her? You know, what drove her to do that massive amount of research for the 2009 book with Ken Rogoff? And really, I think what drives her is her fascination with debt overhangs, that these debt overhangs are always created and then always transferred.
Yeah, she wrote a paper. This is one we did not mention last week, but this was back in 2011, the liquidation of government debt. And it was also something that she used as a presentation for the Bank of International Settlements, June of that year. And it's a fascinating study. But in a period of debt overhangs, that is when a country has too much debt, which we discussed last week, relief comes in a number of forms. The two that are targeted now, negative rates, like higher rates of inflation, it reshuffles the debtor deck and it disperses the cost of debt across a much broader audience. And you heard this notion discussed a long time ago from our friend at Edinburgh, Russell Napier.
Right. Because
again, it's a question of choosing the winners and choosing the losers. We're in the phase where winners and losers are being sorted, they're being designated. And for you to hear this from me, you've probably heard it too many times, and quite frankly, who cares? But for you to understand that our analysis reflects the real world, like it or not, and that real world is being shaped by policy advisors and policymakers, you need to hear from someone other than me that you should, and I'm going to quote Carmen, never underestimate the government's ability to create a captive audience, end quote. Never underestimate the government's ability to create a captive audience. For those that are not tuning in, it reminds me of Buffett's comment on playing cards. Do you remember when he says, if you can't figure out who the patsy is at the card table, it's probably you.
Okay. Yeah, it is me.
So what is our preference? Our preference is that you as a listener avoid the patsy status, that you avoid being financially corralled into assets that will separate you from your hard-earned money. That's it.
Well, I'm going to roll back also to something that Carmen said. You know, I mentioned the 24 years of slow growth. And, you know, with this debt overhang, debt creates slow growth over time because you have stolen from the future. And I'm thinking about some of the things that are in the news right now where you have all these tankers that are just floating and not able to deliver goods. I mean, imports into Southern California ports are in free fall at this point.
Yeah, well, this is the time of year when major product shipments are made from Asia, China specifically, but from Asia, and they come over to the United States.
Gearing up for the holiday.
Gearing up for the holiday selling season. So retailers are bringing in the goods at this time of year for holiday buying, and you've got imports into Southern California ports, which have declined this last month by 4.3%. You've got LA, which is actually up about 1%. Long Beach is down 10. I don't know if you've ever been through the Long Beach port, but it's
massive.
Huge.
Yeah.
It's huge. So at the same time, you couple that with restaurant traffic, which is also falling. And what it communicates to me is that the consumer is cautious. And the retailers who are running their businesses are looking at foot traffic and saying, we need to be cautious too. So back to the food chains, you've got massive discounting with the food chains, promotions with free food to bring in customers. Those promotions accounted for 25% of all sales into fast food restaurants this last quarter. It just tells you that in order to get people to even show up, you've got to create an incentive. So, you know, we've talked about central banks creating incentives, carrots and sticks. Well, retailers have to do the same thing. Now, what happens? What's the consequence? Fourth quarter earnings reflect the fact that they've had to basically give it away. Margins have been squeezed and earnings are ugly because of this. Do we expect retailers to suffer in the third and fourth quarter? Actually, we do.
Okay. But let's say you're a policymaker. Let's say that you're with the Federal Reserve and you see these numbers and you see that things are falling. There's some equations that's going to tell you that you can stimulate that economy. I mean, look at Forbes brought out something that I thought was interesting. You talk often about the early German hyperinflation back from 1920 to roughly 1922 and a half, 23. But, you know, it was the intellectuals back then that said, you know, we can beat this thing just by printing money.
Well, that's right. There wasn't enough economic activity. And they said, well, that's because there's not enough money in the system. But if we put more money into the system, if we were to create liquidity, that would improve wages, that would improve economic activity.
And it worked.
And it did work. It worked very well.
Initially.
It worked too well. So in the 1920s, the hyperinflation, Forbes recollected in their most recent issue that the professors could not recognize the ill-conceived policies until it was too late. And the system blew up.
Right.
Then the elegant solutions that had been proposed, they were intellectually tarred and feathered as absurdities. But from within their paradigm, the professors could not conceive of what might go wrong. Does that have echoes of history into today? I think so.
Well, and Carmen actually touched on that just briefly, if you remember. She said, you know, the trick is going to be to not let that inflation get too high.
Well, that's right. The challenge for a central banker is always looking at two horses. The one horse is a dead horse, and that's the deflation horse. And it's difficult to get that horse back up and trotting, right? So doesn't matter how much you beat it. A dead horse is a dead horse. The other horse is a stallion, which they assume can be reined in. And so they fear inflation less than they do deflation, because inflation is a stallion to be tamed. And they recognize that they're skilled at taming virtually anything, whereas it takes something of a necromancer to raise the dead. And they're not claiming to be quite into those dark arts.
Well, and in economics, there's so many moving parts, because if you have a slowdown in growth, you may have a slowdown in, say, buying from other partner countries like Mexico or what have you.
Sure. So not only are imports declining into the Southern California ports, but you look at sort of the ancillary data. Mexican peso has dropped to an all-time low. Think about that. The Mexican peso has dropped to an all-time low. They are a primary U.S. trade partner, right? And of course, their currency is going to be impacted somewhat by lower oil prices. But we are not currently at the low end of the range, nor have we been at the low end of the range for oil for some time.
So what you're saying is Mexico's peso has dropped because our buying from them has dropped.
We're buying less. Right. Their economy is not as strong. Okay. Their currency is weaker consequently. The Canadian dollar is weak as well. I met with the precious metals mining CEO this past week, and we discussed specifically the declining Canadian dollar as a very positive factor in Canadian miner performance in the present.
Mm.
It's like adding 25% to the gold price, right?
Because they're paying their employees, they're paying for everything that brings it out of the ground in cheaper currency.
That's right. Labor costs are in loonies, just like, you know, for the miners who are down in Mexico. They're paying their labor in the cheapest currency, you know, vis-a-vis the dollar, you've got the Mexican peso, which has tanked. Those expenses are very, very inexpensive relative to the gold price at $1,300. It increases their profitability considerably.
Is this a reason why Ford is moving one of their plants down to Mexico at this time?
No. Ford is announcing that they're moving all of their small car manufacturing to Mexico.
All of it?
Small car. All of their small car manufacturing.
Wow.
And I'm sure we'll have comments from Trump on that. I'm also sure that Ford is making political contributions which are predominantly DNC-centric.
Well, Dave, without being political, which is really hard to do this time of year, I just want to hear the numbers, because you said Trump might have something to say about that. And, you know, honestly, it's horrible to me to see Ford moving all of the small car production down to Mexico. But on the other side of the equation, it's also horrible to see Ford go out of business because they can't sell cars. Businesses have to do what they're going to do. Now, Trump has made some statements that when he becomes president, if he becomes president, he may not be able to carry out. But let's say you're a China and you're looking at a possible Trump win. Let's say you're Mexico and you're looking at a possible Trump win. What should we look at economically from a global participation standpoint or global trade standpoint?
I'm reading a fantastic biography on Alexander Hamilton and about halfway through. And one of his suggestions, he was about 30 years old when he was sort of trying to fix the world and do it more or less according to a British paradigm. He had a lot of respect for the Bank of England and a number of the things that were obviously more centralized and less dispersed through the states.
You'd have probably interviewed him on the commentary had we had it at the time.
I would have enjoyed that conversation. I feel like I'm having one with him right now, in fact. But, you know, 5% is what he wanted to see as a tariff on all imports.
Right.
And, you know, 5% may be tolerable. Trump's suggesting anywhere from 15 to 45% tariffs on imported Chinese goods. And if there's anything that has the ring of Smoot-Hawley and the protective tariffs that we saw back in the 1930s, we may make America great and we may make America greatly poor if we implement those kinds of policies. Consider this. This is not only an international relations gaffe, but an interconnected global economy where we're throwing on 45% tariffs onto imported Chinese goods means that the Chinese GDP basically goes to the slaughterhouse. Kevin Lai at Hong Kong's Daiwei Capital Markets has done the numbers, and a 45% tariff on the goods that are imported from China into the United States would cost Chinese GDP 4.82%. In other words, close to a 5% markdown in their total economic activity, gross domestic product. And I can tell you that is beyond catastrophic. If it's not 45%, the tariffs from Trump, it's 15%, then you've got a hit of 1.8%. Minus 1.8% of Chinese GDP would be cut. And you got to know that that is not something that inspires kindness and gentleness on the part of the Chinese.
Right.
That kind of economic pressure experienced domestically is going to find expression internationally. And I don't think we're going to like what we find.
I have to think sometimes things are said for political reasons because people just don't understand. And then things are done quite different when the person takes office. I was talking to Senator Kent Lambert, who we've had on this program, and he had a meeting with Trump's economic advisor, who is very libertarian in his thinking and non-tariff in his thinking. So I have to wonder what actually will happen if Trump actually takes the White House. I would imagine a lot of the strong things that he's saying right now are probably going to have to be softened up as they run the numbers.
It reminds me of what Cicero said. You can't hold me accountable for what I said yesterday. So much has changed since then.
Right. I'm a free agent is what he said.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Well, Dave, talking about Trump possibly changing his mind once he gets into office, if he does, you know, red tape seems to be one of the things that really slows businesses down. And, you know, Republicans and Democrats both a lot of times create red tape. But Trump, being a businessman, he has said that he would cut red tape. And right now, businesses seem to need it.
You just look at things differently if you have some operating experience in the world of business. You look at healthcare costs and you talk to anybody who owns a business. And since Obamacare has come on board, last year up 20%, the next year up 60%, healthcare costs are ratcheting higher and higher and higher. And that's a significant burden that many business owners say is pressuring their business viability. Okay, so there's that aspect. That's just an illustration of you bring somebody on who has some business experience, who's actually made a payroll payment.
Right.
And there's a different perspective that's brought. I mean, the world is different. Different countries operate differently. And there's ideas of the way things should be. You try to start a business in India, and it'll take you years to cut through the red tape. There's other places where it's a matter of days to get a business license and boom, you're up and running and going.
Right.
And you're good to go. We still have one of the freer places in the world to start a business with relatively limited red tape. But what's interesting, I was reading an article from Business Insider and it suggested this, that the number of new businesses in the U.S. are collapsing.
Mm.
And it's a bit of an issue. And I don't know what really is causing the collapse in new business startups. I don't know if that's a demographic issue. I don't know if it's a, you know, perspective issue. People coming out of college today are less risk prone, or I really don't know how to wrap my mind around it.
But most activity seems to be in mergers and acquisitions, not really creating something new.
There's not a lot of new creation. There is a lot of gobbling up. Mergers and acquisitions, you're right. 30,000 a year is what we're averaging these days. In the 1990s, it was about 11,500 a year. And so bigger firms continue to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's true whether you're talking about manufacturing or banking or what have you. Top five in banking, in the year 2000, they had 25% market share. And today, the top five banks have 45% market share. And so, you know, this period where Dodd-Frank was supposed to address the too big to fail, it's actually doing quite the opposite. And here we are coming up against a deadline with money market funds and a mass exodus thanks to Dodd-Frank, where guess who's actually being hurt, not helped by this action?
It's the businesses.
Banks and corporations.
Yeah.
Which says to me that Dodd-Frank was just ill-conceived from the get-go. There's $700 billion which has come out of money market funds since January of 2015. $700 billion. And it's expected that another $200 to $300 billion is going to hit the exits before October 14th. And, you know, this is money market funds that we're investing in commercial paper and certificates of deposit, that is bank CDs. So the short-term funding needs right. of banks and the short-term funding needs of corporate America are being cut off. And who's the beneficiary? The beneficiary, when you count the $700 billion that's already left and the $200 to $300 billion that's likely to come, this is an extra $1 trillion.
It's the monopoly Treasury Department.
It's going straight into Treasuries
yeah.
because there is an extra benefit, an extra measure of safety. And again, that recalls last week's discussion with Carmen Reinhart. Corralling investors into certain asset classes. It's done by carrot. It's done by stick. In this case, it's a blend. But you now have this audience of treasury buyers, this audience of treasury buyers. And what has happened here? Macroprudential rules. That's what the Dodd-Frank legislation is called. Macroprudential rules. They are creating a world in which money is fleeing one asset class, going to another. And it's, again, it's by design. It's by design.
Right.
To me, it's a little bit eerie. Sorry, that was tangential on the money market funds. My real point was that Trump may cut through a lot of red tape, and Trump may introduce a risk-taking and entrepreneurial environment, which is very healthy for the U.S. economy. That's about all I can say that would be positive from a Trump administration. That's kind of obvious given his CV, because quite frankly, he doesn't have experience doing anything else except getting things done in the world of business. So maybe, just maybe, he could create an environment where that's possible. And economic growth from that standpoint is intriguing.
Well, I think the people have to weigh the issues very carefully, because you look at the way the establishment people are leaning. Establishment is leaning, whether you're Democrat or Republican. Over on the Hillary side, this morning, George Bush Sr. announced that he will be voting
for Hillary.
Well, of course, he's going to
really?
Be voting for Hillary. He really did.
I was joking. You're kidding me.
No, I'm not kidding. And because there's an establishment that really doesn't want to see things shaken up, and Trump scares them. Now, again, I'm not campaigning for either side.
No, but that's what my dad would say. My dad would say, look, I'm interested in Trump because he's not the establishment, not because of anything else. I'm not saying that he's a good person. I'm
right.
not saying that he's a Christian. I'm not saying that he's talented or he's the best man for the job. We've already proven that we've put on the table two people who are not qualified for the job. But
right.
between the two, who is anti-establishment? Who is not establishment? It's Trump.
He's scaring the status quo. And I'm thinking also of Greenspan. Okay, look at what Greenspan said just recently.
It's fascinating. What do we have ahead of us? Greenspan says we have stagflation, no stable equilibrium, rising Social Security and healthcare costs, which are crowding out private investment, which means corporations can't spend their cash because they expect to see their budgets go up in areas that they're not able to control.
Yes, but he still says he fears the crazies that might take over.
I fear the crazies taking over. And I'm frankly not sure who he's talking about. He was around under the Clinton administration, and things were not exactly sane, but it could mean Hillary's deplorables as well. I mean, I don't know.
Right.
But listen, when Greenspan reflects and says, we have stagflation, do you know what he said? He said, number one, inflation rates are higher than you expect, higher than they're being reported. And number two, growth rates in the economy are lower than being reported. We have stagflation. That's very significant. Love him, hate him. Remember his idealistic days. Remember his more pragmatic days. However you think of Alan Greenspan, I think he's hitting the nail on the head. Yes, we have stagflation. No, there's no stable equilibrium. Yes, there are inputs into companies that are tagging the bottom line for corporations and have them cautious in terms of business spending, which leaves us with one conclusion. Yes, we have to see more fiscal spending if we're going to see the economy not go into free fall. And that's a politically contentious idea, which means, guess what? Early 2017, the markets are likely to be roiled. Roiled! Because the only Hail Mary is fiscal policy, spending, and you can't snap your fingers and make it happen.
Well, it's going to happen on either side, too. It's going to either be Republican or Democrat. Whoever you vote for, there will be fiscal spending.
That's right. That's right. Maybe you heard it here first. If Hillary's elected, 6 months into her term, guess who the Treasury Secretary is who's appointed?
You wouldn't be thinking of Ken Rogoff, would you?
Anything's possible. The curse of cash is maybe just the beginning of a brave new world. Just a walk down memory lane. This month, 87 years ago, the stock market reached a level that it would not return to, that it would not see for 25 years. After posting record highs on September 3rd, the market became very volatile. It registered valuation levels that were suggestive of low future returns, which is a polite way of saying that if you'd overpaid for something in the late 1920s, you were going to take your lumps. You were going to take some big ones over an extended period of time. And it was over a month later that the market had its October crash.
But there weren't the detractors. There was somebody out there at that time that was crying foul, and he was saying, watch out.
Babson, among others, but Babson was a budding economist of the day. And this would have been in stark contrast to Irving Fisher. Irving Fisher, who would have said, look, now's the time to back up the truck. You want to own stocks. He was recommending stocks up until Black Monday.
Isn't it amazing that when you talk to central bankers, they almost always quote Irving Fisher as the guru?
But Babson, you know, who the college is named after back on the East Coast, he had said for 2 years that there were bubble dynamics that were brewing and that ultimately the market was going to burst.
Yeah.
And then in early September, he came out and he really narrowed his focus and he said, sooner or later, a crash is coming and it may be terrific. And I think those are words that echo with relevance into the present day.
What about buy and hold, Dave? What about buy and hold? You're always going to make money if you just hold it long enough.
Well, that's kind of Jeremy Siegel's notion that you buy stocks for the long run and hold them, and ultimately they outperform. And ultimately, we're all dead, too. So ultimately, I'm not sure that it matters. But if you live long enough to see a recovery...
Well, how long did it take the last time?
Well, that's what I was getting at. 25 years is a long time to go from buying an overpriced asset to seeing it just get back to break even.
And that's how long it took, 25 years from 1929 to get back to break even.
That's right, so about 1954. So 87 years later, reflecting on the market turmoil of the Great Depression, in this environment, two assets make a lot of sense, cash and gold. And if you give me a break, a decline in the market, a significant decline in the market, and lower valuations in equities, considerably lower, then there's all kinds of assets which would be compelling again. And until that time being, I think the sidelines is advisable. If you have the skills as a portfolio manager to hedge risk in your portfolio, that's fine. Otherwise, being in the market today, if you're not actively hedging those risks, it's like putting snakes in the sandbox and then letting the kids go play. Sometimes it's better that you just don't play.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.